Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Ben Pink Dandelion, and I convene the Quaker Studies Research Association, and I also look after the work of the Centre for Postgraduate Quaker Studies. It's those two bodies that co-sponsor the George Richardson Lecture. So a warm welcome to the 2011 George Richardson Lecture. The lecture actually began at the University of Sunderland when there was a Centre for Quaker Studies there. And that's why it's named after George Richardson, who was a North Shields grocer, a weighty evangelical friend who wrote to the Friend in 1662 and whose letter may have led to the formation of the Friend's Foreign Mission Association. 1862. I've got the 17th. Oh. Okay, thank you. 1862.
Somebody you're going to have to add.
Yes. It's a bit of the second period you don't know about. Okay. Good. Well, so the lecture typically lasts up to an hour, and then there's time for comments and questions, and we'll finish definitely by 6:30 at the very latest. So, very pleased indeed to welcome Rosemary Moore as this year's lecturer, a colleague of mine here at the Centre for Postgraduate Quaker Studies, and well known, I think, to all of us who are involved in Quaker studies, but particularly 17th century Quaker history. She's edited Elwood's History of Quakerism, worked with Mel Kaiser on the works of Isaac Pennington, written various articles for the Ecclesiastical History Society and for Quaker Studies, the journal. But probably best known for her doctoral work and the book that came out of it, this well-thumbed library copy shows how important it is, The Light in Their Consciences, The Early Quakers in Britain, 1646 to 1666. And it's really no exaggeration to say that, you know, this is the book that you need to read if you're interested in what's happening in the 1650s. And it makes seems really common sense to us now, but at the time Rosemary pioneered a new way of doing that kind of archival historical research by only using the tracts of each year that she was examining. I mean, it seems common sense to us now, but it hadn't been done before. And so we'd had very generalised accounts of theology and theological change, which Rosemary was able to sort out very clearly. And it's very exciting, I think, to all of us with an interest in the 17th century. Rosemary's now turning her attention to the second period, which really, as a whole period, has remained largely untouched since William Charles Braithwaite's second periods of Quakerism. So I'd be very excited to hear what you have to say. And it's a great pleasure to now hand over to Rosemary. Thank
you. Thank you very much. I have a sort of feeling that George Richardson wouldn't have approved of the second period of Quakerism as written by Charles Braithwaite. It was the work, of course, of the Roundtree historians to try and undermine and bring to an end all the evangelical Quakerism of the 19th century, which they didn't like at all. However, now I expect you all know those Roundtree histories, at least by sight. A row of large, solid, dark blue books on the shelves of every meeting house library. Now, they were named in memory of John Wilhelm Rowntree, who was the rising star of British Quakerism at the very end of the 19th century, and who laid the first plans for writing an up-to-date history of Quakers. He died suddenly in 1905, and revised plans were made for these histories, which in the event were written by Rufus Jones and William Charles Braithwaite. And the first came out in 1909 and the last one in 1921, some time ago now, and discussions about their revision or replacement have been in the air for some time. Now, today's lecture does not consider a whole new series, but concerns what may be done but what may need to be done to provide a replacement for the second period of Quakerism, the story of Quakerism in the later part of the 17th century. Well, why the second period? Why not begin at the beginning, with Braithwaite's beginnings of Quakerism? The reason is that so much has been published in recent years on the early period, by me among others, that another book is not a priority. The later 17th century has been much less thoroughly trawled over. There have been books dealing with particular aspects of the period, but no one since Braithwaite has written the full Quaker story of the latter part of the 17th century. And after all these years, the second period remains the standard work. All right, one might add, nobody has written an up-to-date history of the 18th century as it affected Quakers, but one thing at a time. Reading the second period today, if anybody's recently tried it, one is immediately struck by the tone of the book. Now, Braithwaite, like all liberal Quakers at the turn of the 19th century, did not like what had been happening to Quakerism towards the end of the 17th century. The increased institutionalism of Friends at that time led, and I quote, to the declension into quietism, and hence to the evangelicalism from which Slough, the Roundtree historians and their ilk were making it their work to rescue the Society of Friends. 100 years on, we can view this period with less personal baggage and hopefully in a more unbiased manner. We will try to make no value judgments about what was happening. Braithwaite divided the second period into three parts. I mean his book, not the actual historical period. The first part dealt with Quakers in relation to the political situation up to the passing of the Toleration Act in 1689, and thereafter with a struggle to obtain the right to affirm instead of taking an oath, ending with the Affirmation Act of 1722. His second part covered the internal history of Quakerism over the same period, and it's mainly a tale of administrative reform and the resulting controversies, with some account of Quaker colonisation and ending with the deaths of the original leaders, the last of them, George Whitehead, dying in 1723. His third part was a general discussion of the state of Quakerism at the beginning of the 18th century. This arrangement gives the impression that Quaker internal history and Quaker history in relation to British general history were two separate things. In fact, they were continually intersecting. We will try, so far as possible, to arrange our new book chronologically. The Roundtree historians also kept American and British Quaker history separate, treating them in parallel volumes. Actually, at least to the end of the 17th century, and perhaps afterwards, they were two sides to the same story. Quakers had been settling along the eastern seaboard of America since the 1650s, and they kept close ties with their relations in Britain. There was continual intercourse between the two groups, and people went to and fro. I quote from Frederick B. Tollis, who wrote the introduction to the second edition of The Second Period. Friends on both sides of the Atlantic came to feel that they were members of a single community, an Atlantic community of friends. Our book should cover both sides of the Atlantic. I've been talking about our book. Well, as of this moment, it's mainly a twinkle in a few people's eyes, though it did get a little further a couple of days ago. Anyway, it would be quite premature in this lecture to try and finalise a plan for it, but I can give some indication of my idea of what its contents might be. Where should we start? Braithwaite made the dividing line between his first and second books at the Restoration, 1660 to 1661. But when I was working on the early period, I thought it made more sense to continue to 1666, which is just before the time when Fox set important administrative reforms in motion, and by coincidence, is just before Penn and Keith and Barclay arrived on the scene. In the course of the 1670s, Quakerism became a very different entity from what it had been 10 years earlier. However, in order to understand the 1670s, it is necessary to understand the 1660s, when, following the restoration of the monarchy, laws were passed severely restricting the activities of Quakers and others who would not conform to the national church. Our putative new book, therefore, would probably begin in 1660-61, as did Braithwaite's second period. And we would begin, as does Braithwaite, by telling of the fierce persecution of all dissenting bodies which was instigated by the Cavalier Parliament in the early 1660s. Unlike Braithwaite, we would couple this with an account of the split in the Quaker movement concerning the right holding of Quaker meetings, which was inspired by the teaching of a noted Quaker travelling minister named John Perrott. He was the one who said, you don't really need to take off your hat when you are praying in meeting if you're not moved to do so. So it's called the hat controversy. Caused an awful lot of trouble. Why do we put the two together? What was happening in politics generally and what was happening to Quakers? Because during this period of persecution, George Fox was in prison from 1663 to late 1666. And for much of this time, he was prevented from having any contact with his followers. The absence of the main Quaker leader at a crucial time affected both the history of the Perrott dispute about hats and also later events when the Quaker movement tried to put itself together again. Now, Braithwaite was a very thorough and careful historian, and his factual work stands. To update his account of the persecutions, we shall need, firstly, to set them in the context of recent works on British social and political history. Especially, this means looking at the activities of the radical underground, Quakers and others, and especially Samizdat's printers, during the years after the restoration of 1660. And secondly, we shall need to take account of the work of the many local historians who have been active since Braithwaite's time. The evidence is that persecution was patchy, the high periods being the early 1660s and the early 1880s. One magistrate might prosecute Quakers enthusiastically. Others preferred to look the other way. Non-payment of tithes and church rates could lead to goods being distrained, but again, not in every place all the time. The first wave of persecution eased off in 1667, when there was a change of government ministers, which allowed Quakers and all the other dissenters to regroup. And it was then that things began to happen that were to change the nature of Quakerism. George Fox, released from Scarborough Castle, undertook a major reorganisation of the movement. He met with John Perrott's followers, and most of them returned to what we may now perhaps call establishment Quakerism. Fox wanted to strengthen the movement, to make it difficult for any future dissidents to gain support, and also to provide assistance in times of persecution. For the next few years, he was mainly occupied in setting up the Quaker structure, which still exists in essentials today. Ad hoc arrangements, which had proved their worth, were built into a strong national organisation. The practice of holding regular annual meetings of leading friends was revived. Monthly meetings for business had been an early development in some areas, and Fox extended them to the whole country in 1667-8. The county meetings, which mirrored local government areas for the purpose of monitoring persecution, had been originally set up in 1658, and now were revived and reinvigorated, becoming known as quarterly meetings. 6 weeks meeting, which still manages the property of all the London meetings, dates from 1671, and from the beginning it included both men and women. Persecution and disease had caused many deaths, leaving George Fox, Margaret Fell, and George Whitehead as the main survivors of the original group of leading friends. But Quakers of a new kind and quality were arriving on the scene. In 1663, a small but important Quaker meeting appeared in Aberdeen. One of the first members was the academic George Keith, and in 1666, Robert Barclay joined them. Keith and Barclay gave a new intellectual rigour to Quaker writing. Keith, like Naylor before him, has been marginalised in Quaker history. He ultimately left the movement after a serious dispute. But for 30 years, he was at least as important as Barclay, whom he probably influenced. Unfortunately, there are no good modern studies of either Keith or Barclay, and this will be a difficult gap for our new book to fill. And then in 1667, a young man by the name of William Penn threw in his lot with the Quakers. He was the wealthy son of an admiral, with access to the corridors of power. During the brief reign of James II, he played an important role in British politics. And he was, of course, a major figure in early American history. For many years, he was the main publicist for Quakerism, his works including Theology, Devotion, and Political Theory. He is noted as being the defendant, along with another Quaker, William Mead, in the Bushell trial of 1670, which established the right for English juries to come to their verdict independently of the wishes of the judge. He was outstanding in debate. There is no good modern biography of Penn, although there are a number of studies of his work and influence. Such a many-sided person is going to be difficult to deal with adequately within our book. We shall need to give due weight to his place in Quaker history, while not diminishing his national and international importance. Other dissenters besides Quakers took advantage of the freer atmosphere of the later 1660s and early 1670s. Set disputes and pamphlet wars, of a kind not seen since the Restoration, again became the order of the day. For some reason, this did not interest Braithwaite, and he doesn't mention them. Most of these controversies were with Baptists, who now had time and energy to renew their ancient feud with the Quakers. As Luke Howard of Dover put it, "The Baptists began first with us. As soon as the king gave liberty, they fell on us." There were disputes with Baptists in Kent and Lincolnshire, and a major set piece at the Baptist Barbican meeting house in London, which consisted of four meetings between 1672 and 1674. It was attended at times, it is said, by 3,000 people, and at one time it was adjourned because a crack appeared in the building. It led to the publication of 15 pamphlets by Whitehead, Penn, and others in answer to the Baptists. No detailed account of these disputes has been published, and it would be good if our treatment of them could be buttressed by input from Baptist historians. From 1671 to 1673, Fox was in America, for the purposes of consolidating the Quaker position in the various colonies and establishing a similar organisation to that now operating in Britain. At this point, we shall need to update Braithwaite and Rufus Jones on the early history of Friends in America. Books have been written, and there are many journal articles to be considered, most of them in the American journal Quaker History. If we have not yet enlisted the help of American colleagues, we shall need to do it now. Disciplinary matters continued to occupy Friends, and an important part of the maintenance of discipline was the control of publications. This became the work of the second day morning meeting set up in 1673. This meeting decided to keep two copies of all books written by Friends and also one copy of adverse publications so they could be more effectively answered. This is the origin of the Library of the Society of Friends at Friends House in London. The committee's policy was to reject anything that might bring the movement into disrepute, particularly apocalyptic prophecy, which was now right out of fashion and considered unsuitable. Poorly written work would also be turned down if it couldn't be revised. And Christine Trivett's work has shown how this made it much more difficult for some women who tended to be less educated, and the Welsh, who maybe weren't so good in English, to get their work published at all. And we'll need to look further into the records of the second day morning meeting. The final piece of the national organisation was put in place in 1676. From their beginnings, Quakers had accepted that they must be willing to suffer for their faith, but many of them took the view that there was no need to suffer illegally or unnecessarily. It may have been a result of Fox's last imprisonment from 1673 to 75 that they decided to create a new committee to monitor prosecutions of Friends and take legal advice to minimise them. It was known as Meeting for Sufferings. In the second period, Braithwaite suggested that Friends were reluctant to take legal action against persecutors. But while this was true in the case of some individuals, it was not the case generally, as later scholars have made clear. In fact, Quakers became known as very awkward customers in the courts, and we will supply examples. We now need to go back a few years and to consider the origins of the separate business meetings for women, that distinctive feature of Quaker organisation. There were women's meetings in London from about 1658, but the early development of the other women's meetings is unclear. There are epistles of Fox encouraging the establishment of these meetings, but the early ones are undated. They probably come from the later 1660s and were concerned with Fox's general reorganisation of that time. One purpose of Fox's visit to America in 1671-3 was to encourage a similar kind of organisation on that side of the Atlantic. And there, the women's meetings appear to have been set up without controversy, though this will need checking. However, in Britain, they met with resistance. Some resistance, anyway. The root of the problem was the men's meetings' dislike of the proposal that the women's meetings should have the power to inquire into the fitness of men's marriages. This had been the practice in London, at least since 1663, but elsewhere it was a novelty. And there was a wave of internal disruption, which is called the Wilkinson Story separation after two of the chief agitators. And it may well have been occasioned as much by resentment at Fox's authoritarianism and maybe by Margaret Fell's meddling, as by objections to the institution of women's meetings as such. It is a confused episode which will need careful examination. In Bristol, for instance, women's meetings apparently were okay, but women's monthly meetings were very much not okay. There's a lot to be studied. Braithwaite's histories have been criticised as dealing too exclusively with institutional Quakerism. Now, there's two points here. One is that the institutions of Quakerism are distinctive and therefore interesting, and are also quite possibly what assured its survival during the worst of the persecutions. The second point is that there was a lack of information about local meetings at the time when Braithwaite was writing. But since his time, there have been major studies of Friends in Buckinghamshire, Lancashire, and Essex. At least two sets of monthly meetings have been transcribed and published, while others are available in typescript at Friends House. These minutes of business meetings can give useful information about ordinary Quakers. One often finds problems with walking disorderly, which might be drunkenness or sexual misbehaviour, marrying your housekeeper or not marrying your housekeeper after your wife had died in particular. But on the other hand, much care is always given to Friends in difficulties. And the records from both sides of the Atlantic are similar. One finds notes of contact between American and British meetings, such as two occasions when the Baltimore Women's Meeting received presents of books from the London Women's Meeting and decided in return they would send them two hogsheads of tobacco. Regarding recent studies, here in Woodbrook we have six unpublished recent PhD theses dealing with the development of Quakerism in particular localities. There have been a number of small books written by local historians on behalf of particular meetings. And no doubt, there are many more papers hidden in local history journals and local conference reports. And studies like these use local archives as well as Quakerly records. And it is also worth looking at local histories not primarily written for or about Quakers. One may find something about Quakers in them. So we shall certainly have a chapter in our book on the Friend on the Bench, though a considerable amount of work will have to be done in collating all this information and identifying and filling the gaps. We shall need to look at dissidents. Some made themselves well known because they published pamphlets setting forth their views. William Mucklow of London and William Rogers of Bristol were main protagonists in the struggle against Fox's administrative reforms. Then there were wealthy eccentrics like Robert Rich, a Barbados merchant, and John Penniman, a London draper, who both, being wealthy and active people, both caused considerable annoyance to establishment Quakerism. But besides these, there must have been others who didn't like the way Quakerism was developing and just slipped quietly away. Rufus' book on early Quakerism in America does mention people leaving meetings because they did not like the formalism introduced by Fox. And probably the same thing happened this side of the Atlantic. Maybe we can find some of these people. What do we now know about Quaker life in general? As the century progressed, Quakers adapted their practices just sufficiently to be tolerable to their contemporaries. They continued to address everyone as thou and to refuse to take off their hats in situations where you were supposed to, and they dressed plainly, and they took no part in sports. But they became known as merely taciturn and gloomy, rather than rude and strident as in the early days. And relations with their neighbours, if not warm, were not necessarily hostile. The earliest Quaker disciplinary document, the Epistle of the Elders of Balby in 1656, advised Friends that if any are called to serve the Commonwealth in any public service, that with cheerfulness it be undertaken and in faithfulness discharged. And evidence is accumulating that Quakers did in fact take their share in local parish duties, even on occasion acting as church wardens, even on occasion applying the law against fellow Quakers, believe it or not. Well, in the long run, many Quaker practices became accepted as mere eccentricities, but of course this took time. But there is some evidence that Quaker efforts to present themselves as harmless began to take effect during the 1660s and were well established by the 1670s. There's a book I came across dated 1668, where the author warned his readers to be no longer imposed on by the Quakers' seeming innocence. And I found a work written 1674 describing the common view of Quakers, which he didn't really agree with, as being very demure in their carriage, very austere in their lives, sober and temperate, very punctual and just in their dealings, and if any man should strike them on their cheek, these poor innocent souls were so far from revenge that they would turn the other. This author thought this was window dressing. From the beginning, friends were expected to demonstrate their faith by their way of life, and certainly the seeds of their reputation for philanthropy, honesty, and hard work go back to the 1650s. A preliminary look at the evidence indicates that a typical male friend worked for himself in a small way of business. And in 1656, Fox issued a warning that those friends whose businesses were doing well should not allow their business to interfere with their duty to their meeting. Otherwise, he said, the Lord would take away from them what they had. Friends gained a reputation for strict honesty in business, and it worked to their advantage. And there's evidence from these anti-Quaker writings that despite all the fines and distraints of property, some friends were doing very well. In 1671, the alleged fair dealing of Quakers was described by another one who disliked Quakers as a falsity. For he cheats worse than a long lane broker by pretending to deal at a word. And the hook whereby he draws his customers is a far-fetched sigh and a plainly I tell thee, friend. Quakers, said this author, were as a people generally subtle, frugal, industrious, and wary in their dealing, by which, and their large pretensions to a punctual honesty, they have engrossed a large part of the nation's trade. 1671, this. 1674, another author writes, whereas many of them have been known to have been persons of mean fortune at first, they are now rich and wealthy, and none of them in a necessitous condition, though very poor before they turned Quaker. So a lot of feeling that Quakers are doing well and getting rich. And this comes from the other side, not Quaker records. Well, there's little contemporary evidence as to why this was happening, but at a slightly later date, there's information from diaries and correspondence which show that many Quakers who were in a small way of business found that their regular attendance at meetings was also a good way of increasing trade, and it could lead to advantageous marriages, so that small units might grow and coalesce into larger ones. Boys were sent to do their apprenticeships in other Quaker businesses, which made further contacts. All this tends to build up the wealthy Quakers of the 18th century. Nowadays, the best-known characteristic of Quakers is their peace testimony. The traditional view, the traditional Quaker view, that the peace testimony was part of Quakerism from the beginning, has become untenable. For there's much evidence that there were, in fact, early Quakers who were proud of their army service, and others who were involved with the militias which were raised in the disturbed circumstances of 1659. while also examples of very militaristic language on the part of George Fox have been uncovered. You probably know the thing, one Quaker soldier is worth seven ordinary soldiers. And it is a fact that Fox never condemned those friends who had fought in the army, and he was at least ambivalent about foreign words, but he was strongly against Quaker participation in any domestic plots and insurrections. And yet, not all Quakers were in agreement with the Peace Testimony Declaration of 1661, and some Quakers were certainly involved in the Northern Plot of 1663. After that, Fox's view largely prevailed in Britain, and at the same time, the political situation settled down. The principle of avoiding participation in military matters did cause Quakers some difficulties in regarding the requirement to supply or pay for men for the militia, and Quaker records contain several instances of distraint for this reason. Now, non-Quaker historians have assumed that this general acceptance of the peace testimony came largely for political reasons, that friends needed very urgently to get the reputation of being peaceful folk. But actually, between the Northern Plot and the Monmouth Rebellion, matters relating to the peace testimony were a minor consideration in Britain. Britain itself was fairly peaceful. Not so in America, where Rufus Jones' account suggests that when Quakers were involved in violence, it was because circumstances were beyond their control. In fact, what happened was much more nuanced, and events in the American colonies were more illuminating than events in Britain, which is another reason for making our book cover both sides of the Atlantic. Quaker authors, and notably among these Isaac Pennington, had suggested that Quakers were forbidden by God themselves to take part in fighting, but that no such rule in an imperfect world applied to non-Quakers. For according to St. Paul, Romans 13:4, it was the duty of magistrates to bear the sword and keep the peace. Braithwaite and Jones did not consider the situation faced by Quakers in a position of authority in time of war when they were themselves the magistrates. A recent detailed study of Rhode Island during the events known as King Philip's War, which happened 1675-6, when Quakers formed the government in Rhode Island, has shown considerable differences in the reactions of Quakers to the situation. Those in positions of governmental responsibility, though they did not personally command troops, took the view that it was their duty to see to the defence of the citizens. Their social responsibility overrode their individual preferences. The extent to which individual Quakers felt free to participate in war or preparations for war, when they were responsible only for themselves and their families, was a matter between them and God, and it varied. How did the theological side of the Quaker faith develop in this period? Now, early Quakers had been fiercely attacked for doctrinal unorthodoxy. Quakers denied the authority of the Bible and of ordained ministers. They disbelieved in the Trinity, the Incarnation, and the Atonement. They took as their authority the light within, which other people thought was just conscience, and they asserted themselves to be united with Christ and therefore capable of moral perfection. And Fox, Nailers, and some others were tried for blasphemy more than once, and Quakers became aware that they were very vulnerable to such accusations and did change their language just a little. The big changes came in the 1670s. Now, Braithwaite did write one chapter on Quaker faith in the early part of the second period. It's not a very useful chapter for us. He concluded that the theology of Quakers in the second period was inadequate for modern Quakers. Well, this doesn't really matter to us, and we are more concerned with the actual situation from 1670 to 1700, when the problem was to convince the authorities that Quakers were theologically respectable. And the main protagonists were Barclay, Keith, Penn, and Whitehead. And at this time, the early emphasis on union with Christ disappears. Quakers gave no ground on the need to receive Christ in spirit, but at the same time they tried to make clear they really did believe in the work of the historic Jesus. And you begin to find, or rather you don't find, so much mention of the light. It begins to get marginalised. Now, late on a Saturday afternoon is not the best time for considering theology, and some of this is very tricky, but you might like to think of the best-known example of what was going on, Fox's letter to the governor of the Barbados, which was produced to smooth Fox's way on the occasion of his visit in 1671. It was part of our Book of Discipline as up to the revision of the Book of Discipline in 1960, and the older ones, like me, may remember it. we don't know that Fox wrote it. A lot of people think he didn't. My guess is Penn, however. It was written, and it appears in Fox's journal, and it was also separately published. So it was important. The first part of it, in the form of a creed, expressing belief in God, who is the creator of all things, and in Jesus Christ, his beloved and only begotten Son, who was conceived by the Holy Ghost and born of the Virgin Mary, in whom we have redemption through his blood, even the forgiveness of sins. A great echo of Anglican creeds here. And then it goes on to explain why Quakers call the scriptures the words rather than the word of God, and there is no mention whatsoever of the light within. Well, Fox certainly accepted this to the extension of making use of it and including it in his journal. But the question has been raised as to whether Fox was really in agreement with these new expressions of Quaker beliefs. And they're certainly very different from the early Quaker writings. Some people have thought that maybe he was under pressure, but one has a feeling putting pressure on George Fox wouldn't have been the easiest thing to do. So what was going on? And this is something, don't take for as gospel what I'm going to say, because there's a lot of argument about this, which will go on. But it is a fact that he remained on very good terms with these new men and what they were writing. He travelled with Barclay, Keith and Penn on an expedition to Holland and Germany in 1677, and you'll find him in their company on other occasions. All seems to be sweetness and light. And we know that at least on one occasion he wrote to Penn in prison and said, get on and do some more writing, you're being idle, or words to that effect. The thing is that Quakers had to be seen to be Orthodox Trinitarian Christians if they were to be acceptable in 17th century British society. And Fox was a realist. And he knew that some change was essential. Because there are items in the collection of Quaker letters called the Swarthmore Manuscripts that show signs of tampering by Fox himself, where he's tried to remove evidence that once upon a time he'd been addressed by Quakers in semi-divine terms. Well, there's a feeling that exact verbal formulations weren't considered of prime importance by the Quakers. When they disowned people, it was for offences against church discipline, not for irregular belief. Creedal statements issued by Quakers, and they did issue them, the letter to the governor of Barbados is just one, when they did issue them, these were intended for the general public and for the government. And they weren't intended for Quakers themselves. So Penn, Keith, Barclay and Whitehead could be permitted to rewrite the Quaker faith. And if Fox had doubts about the way his movement was going, he kept to himself. And again, it looks as possibly inside he did have some doubts. In 1675-6, he dictated his journal, which gave his view of Quaker beginnings as seen from his own perspective. And he followed this by compiling his Book of Miracles, which emphasized his position as charismatic leader. But he did not attempt to have these works printed during his lifetime. Instead, he made provision under his will for their publication after his death. He left it to the next generation. And in the event, his journal was drastically edited before publication, and the Book of Miracles was never published, so that it's only known from fragments. But one knows it existed. Now, up to now, this paper has been looking at the Quaker movement as it was in the 1670s. Since the Restoration, it had been fairly detached from British politics, but this was about to change, and we'll need to look at the Quaker movement in relation to British political history, especially with regard to the reign of James II and the revolution which followed, when one Quaker, William Penn, was for a time very close to the centre of power. Briefly, this is what happened. The heir to the throne was Charles II's brother, the Duke of York, later James II. He caused a furore in 1673 by announcing his conversion to Catholicism, and there was a move to have him excluded from the succession, which gained strength. The morning meeting advised friends to consider their attitudes in the event of a parliamentary election, and to be prepared to support candidates who favoured religious toleration and who were becoming known as Whigs. A separate factor of work, and this was separate, was the wish of Quakers to have their own tract of land in America. William Penn, courtier and aristocrat, was already thinking about a possible colony and was networking with politicians who might be useful to him. Now, Penn, through his weight between the Whigs' interest, remember the reformist-tolerationist interest, in the first of the two elections of 1679. But later that year, as events progressed, he began to think that the King's party might be more useful in attaining his ends, and you find him not supporting his local Whig candidate. And the King was willing to meet some of his more useful opponents halfway, and Penn got his colony. Pennsylvania was then founded, 1681-82, and many British Quakers emigrated during the following years. One byproduct of this was that some meetings, especially in Wales, were weakened to the point of destruction, and there will be something in the book about this. Meanwhile, Charles II, a very skillful politician, succeeded in resisting Parliament's demands for his brother's exclusion from the succession, and like his father before him, he proceeded to reign without Parliament. He died in 1685, to be succeeded by his brother as James II. Now, it has been suggested that Penn and James II were friends. Certainly, they were very useful to each other. Penn wanted toleration for dissenters. James wanted toleration for Catholics. James realised that to obtain toleration for Catholics, it would be a great help to have the dissenters on his side, and Penn was a powerful dissenter. Penn, therefore, moderated his own objections to relief for Catholics. And so the two of them came together. And there was a time in 1686-7 when Penn was effectively James' right-hand man, and he encouraged dissenters to take advantage of James's declaration of toleration, which was being received with suspicion in many quarters, because James had issued it under the royal prerogative and it had not been passed by Parliament. So some friends are wary of James' intentions and of Penn's activities, and Friends as a whole were not united. This is going to need quite a lot of investigation. Neither Penn nor James anticipated the invasion of William of Orange until it was almost upon them, and both have been described as foolish utopians. In the aftermath, Penn was inevitably looked on with suspicion. He was arrested several times and charged with treason, for there was a suggestion he was helping James, as he had estates in the area of Ireland where James had landed. Penn was in hiding from January 1691 to November 1692, and his colony was taken from him, all of which made things uncomfortable for Friends. And there's a recent master's thesis on disaffection towards Penn among Friends in the years after 1691. And it's certainly a fact that many influential Friends had had enough of him. There was opposition to the inclusion of Penn's preface in the first edition of Fox's Journal, and it was probably due to this. Penn had brought the society into disrepute. This was no time to give him publicity. Penn soon began to try to mend fences with the new regime. Kinsale, on his Irish estates, was becoming a major port, so Penn arranged supplies for William III's Irish armies. In 1694, he got his colony back. Quakers were a large and increasingly wealthy minority group. William III needed their support. They had benefited less than the other dissenters from the Toleration Act of 1689, because nothing had been done about the questions of oaths and tithes, which were still causing them major problems. Tithes remained payable to the 20th century, but the government proved willing to meet Friends on the matter of judicial oaths. There was the Affirmation Act of 1696, the first attempt to give relief on this matter, and there was much discussion as to the wording that Friends could accept. Several other acts followed, the final one in 1722, when Friends were at last satisfied with the agreed formula. However, even before these acts were passed, there was a certain amount of compromise in practice. There are many records of courts agreeing to accept a Quaker's word without a formal oath, or of allowing someone else to swear for him. And so the legal situation of Friends was improving. But their position in the 1690s was by no means secure. Only Trinitarians could benefit under the Toleration Act, and Friends' Trinitarian credentials were considered doubtful. George Whitehead published a very Trinitarian conventional creedal statement in 1693, which was intended to settle the matter. And the last thing Friends needed at this time was an attack from inside on their theological respectability. But that happened. George Keith was at this time working as a surveyor in Pennsylvania, and he became concerned at the lack of basic Christian knowledge among the emigrants. And being tactless and arrogant, he got himself disowned by Pennsylvania Yearly Meeting. The dispute transferred to England and occupied much of the Yearly Meeting business of 1695. Like other problem Quakers before him, Keith's main sin was bringing the society into dispute, and he was disowned. And we shall need to look further at Keith, who ended his days as an Anglican vicar. One more thing. Braithwaite doesn't deal with the origins of the great Quaker family businesses that had their roots in the late 17th century. His book predates the modern interest in economic history and industrial archaeology, so we'll need to say something about it. The first of the Lloyds, who were ironmasters before they were bankers, joined Friends in 1663. John Gurney, Norfolk wool merchant, came to Friends in 1683, and his descendants founded a great banking business, and he was also the ancestor of Elizabeth Fry. Abraham Darby I was born to a Quaker family in 1678 and sent as apprentice to a Quaker millwright. His key assistant in his experiments with iron smelting came to him from the Lloyds, the other Quaker business. Then there was the London or Quaker Lead Company, formed at the very end of the 17th century by a Quaker consortium, after the Affirmation Act had eased their legal position. So we're getting to the end of the 17th century. Fox is dead, and a selection of his works is being published. George Whitehead is now the leading friend, Penn never having entirely recovered his status. What remains to be considered, and where are we going to end this book? A full study of George Whitehead is very important, if anybody would like to take it on. As a personality, he was outshone by the flamboyance of Fox and Penn, but he was involved in every important development in Quakerism from the early 1660s onward. It would be good to have a chapter on Anne Conway and her circle. There's much new material published since Braithwaite was writing. And we should have a look here at one of the roads friends did not take. For George Keith was much attracted at one time by the theory of transmigration of souls, as propounded by that fringe Quaker, Mercury von Helmont, who was also a friend of Lady Conway. A study of the Quaker and anti-Quaker literature of the period is underway by me, but it is far from finished. And then, this is the big thing to be done, there is a great mass of manuscript material at Friend's House needing to be gone through. We have an offer of help, but we need lots more volunteers from people who can get up to Friend's House and transcribe manuscripts. It's not that difficult, really, once you get used to it. So where do we end? The next distinctive date in British Quaker internal history is 1737, when a formal membership system was introduced. That's too late. We shall probably have to follow Braithwaite and end with an account of Friends as they were at the beginning of the 18th century, with a nod to the journal writers like John Grattan, John Kelso, Thomas Story and others, and a look ahead to the death of Whitehead in 1723. But first of all, we must get this book written and find an interested publisher. All suggestions and offers of help will be gratefully received. Thank you.
A longer version of the lecture will be in a future edition of Quaker Studies. There's free copies of old issues there and a chance to subscribe to that. And the lecture has been recorded and we hope that will be available on the Woodbrook website. Thank you very much.